Welcome again to our Technology Matters panel discussion. This seventh panel is about biotechnology. So one of the things I want to start off with is this idea that biotechnology in some sense is grounded in an understanding of life, biological life, how it evolves and so on, and chemical processes as well. In order to create biotechnology, you have to have some working understanding of the process of life. But what's interesting, and this came out in all of your research, is that as we develop and develop that understanding and the technology that goes along with it, it actually changes our concept of life. And we never seem to be able to exhaust, at least yet, the kinds of things that we can learn through life by manipulating life. So the first question I had was, how would you all complicate the idea that biotechnology is connected to a notion of human progress, which is something we normally associate with.
And I had some thoughts on that. I wanted to complicate this idea further by looking at what we consider to be human progress and what that word even means. What do we think of as progress, really, when we're thinking about these different biotechnologies that we're creating and implementing? And also, who it is that's benefiting from this progress. We have this idea that biotechnology is connected to a notion of human progress, and it can be complicated by thinking about maybe my own topic, which is the weaponization of the honeybee through our military. It's intended to promote our progress as Americans. It's created by Americans, and it's for Americans. But we're not simply talking about human progress anymore, because we can't narrow it down to just human. It's now we're talking about war, and I think ideally, and maybe personally, that human progress would be spending less on improving war technology, because ideally there wouldn't be a need.
And so I just want to hear just a few things more about the research you did into the honeybee, because in one sense, the weaponization of the honeybee is a use of another organism, or theoretically use of another organism for a human purpose. But in talking about it in your paper, I got the sense that there was also, we need to be mindful of how these things are related. So maybe you want to say a few things about that.
Yeah, I talked a lot in my paper about the ethics of using another living creature as a biotechnology. And the fact that we're able at this point to start creating technologies, like in the DARPA project, I wrote in my paper about this current technology that the military is creating to actually use nanotechnologies and put them into, I think, beehives at the larval stage, and kind of create like this miniature machine, which is essentially this living creature, this living body, but we're creating it as a machine. So I was kind of looking at the ethics of that and thinking about, you know, how there's this great potential to do all these things with that, but also looking at the fact that you are looking at using a living creature to do that.
Yeah, what struck me also, maybe you want to, this may segue nicely into your work on nanotechnology, but your paper also made me think about not just the use of another organism for the purpose of another, but also the difficulty in imagining the relationship and consequences of that use. So, for instance, in manipulating the honeybee, which and its life processes in order to do something else, one of the things you talked about in your paper is our dependence on the honeybee for, you know, other processes outside of just creating honey and, you know, doing other things. So, using nanotechnology to do that is an interesting way to sort of imagine that, or it makes it very difficult to imagine that. But do you want to?
Not exactly sure.
Well, it's not a direct connection, but yeah.
Oh, I think that I can tie that into my paper a lot.
Sure.
Because you're talking about manipulation of like a living being, and in my paper I wrote about computer implants and the technology of that in itself. And there also is kind of like an ethics issue there, whether or not to eliminate the death culture, you know, like whether to implement children when they're young, they don't have a say, kind of thing, to normalize them. And but is that progress towards what we want? Like this normalization, this like standard? I mean, like, who makes that standard, I guess, was, like, a question that I also raised. Like, yeah, even if we do decide to forfeit the child's autonomy to a cochlear implant, what is that progress? Like, what are we normalizing towards, I guess? Like, this technology can be great and useful, you know, to help people hear, but is that what we're striving for?
And the concept that you brought up in your paper that I thought was really useful as a point about this is this idea of perfection, that we're trying to perfect some idea of ourselves or a sense or whatever, and we're all constantly striving to sort of get to that. But then there's this other sense, and this maybe is a good connection to Kelsey's sort of points about honeybees, is that a concept of well-being, and not just the well-being of an individual organism, but the relationship of organisms or organs in our body, right? Is something that we should also think about. It. And it's very different than this idea of perfection, because you have to start with a concept of what you're trying to achieve, whereas seeing the relations between things or the benefits, like you sort of talked about in the paper, about diversity in culture, because instead of like trying to make everyone like each other,
yeah,
in some sense, that we benefit from that, but it's hard to see that benefit, the diversity.
Yeah. So there's, like, a controversy about technology. Like, although it's opened, like, a lot of doors and possibilities, there are positive and negative aspects to it. And it's kind of hard to sometimes see that about technology is always kind of, like, it's enhancing on us medically. You know, it's used to, like, enhance, like, all aspects of it. So a lot of, like, things that can track.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's kind of, like, it kind of takes me back, kind of all the way back to like the old saying, like guns don't kill people. But like, taking the idea from that is that guns aren't inherently bad or inherently good. Same thing with labs, are kind of depending on which way you want to spend the nanotechnology or implants, or like for myself, I did genetic engineering. These technologies aren't inherently bad or inherently good. It's just kind of who uses them and how they're implemented in society. And the idea of progress is, my idea of progress that I took is that it's improving the human experience, and it be through, a lot of the genetic engineering is being done currently is for wider access to food, and like less impact on the environment from raising certain types of crops or certain types of animals. So currently, mostly, it's all about improving food availability for humans, so enabling more people to eat healthier. So improving the lives, but in the future that could change drastically. Like I mentioned also that the more we learn about animals, the more we learn about ourselves, the more we learn about DNA specifically, the more we're able to change it. And we're able to, with the technology even currently, we're able to take DNA from different organisms and implant them into a plant or animal that would never normally have that gene, such as a very specific example of that is actually a salmon. It's an Atlantic salmon that has genes from a Pacific Chinook salmon and another fish called an ocean pout, which is like a kind of an eel, which allows the fish to grow twice as fast as it naturally would. And you could never naturally get those genes within this Atlantic salmon. So it allows for greater availability to people. Because it will grow faster and eventually cost less. But that same technology could be transferred into all sorts of other types of animals and eventually leading into humans, of course, which has a whole Pandora's box, really, of implications and possibilities.
And it's interesting, I don't know, I feel this when I was reading the papers and also just in this topic in general, that there's this odd uneasiness we have about talking about it with respect to human beings, but with respect to like bees or natural processes where we're injecting chemicals and different processes that are somehow not anthropomorphic, that we there's sort of like this invisible divide in talking about it. But one of the things that I thought of when you were speaking was now there's things like bio art, which is like, you know, creating mice with like fluorescent fur and just you know, new organisms, basically. I mean, new in the sense that they wouldn't naturally occur, or if they did occur naturally, who knows how many billions and billions of years it would take for a process to eventually come upon fluorescent mice, or what purpose it would do in that sort of environment.
How it would come about.
Right, how it would come about. So And one way of understanding it that's sort of also putting this political and ethical debate into sort of stark relief is the speed with which we intervene, right? So technology may not be bad or good intrinsically, but the speed with which we use it and the way that those purposes play out over time become something that is very hard to get a handle on, right? So we want more salmon because people are hungry, but at the same time, creating more salmon does something else to another sphere of life that we don't really have any control over.
Oh, I think the transition from this would go good into your topic.
You can just tell us about, I mean, we haven't talked much about nanotechnology, but you talked about nanotechnology and its applications. So maybe if you want to, you know, connect that to...
We did talk about a little bit about kind of like ramifications or the consequences of it, mm-hmm. Biotech, and that's a big thing I talked about. And not to sound totally mean or anything, but once nanotech or medicine does kind of lift off, it's going to be saving a lot of lives, especially cancer. Mm-hmm. It's going to treat cancer effectively and safely, and we kind of have to think of what's going to happen to the resources, pretty much. First or second biggest killer in America or something. I don't know. But,
so what do you mean? What do you mean by resources? Like the resources to do it, or
no? I mean, like right now we're already having kind of we don't have enough resources for everyone on Earth. And if more people are living, I wonder, kind of like what's going to happen with that. You know, once it's going to cure cancer, injuries, other illnesses, and it's pretty much going to be a lot more people on Earth.
I see. So one of the things that, and this connects also to the prosthetics again, the prosthetics panel that we had, but this idea of replacement, so we can live longer because instead of one organ failing and basically ending our lives, we could replace that and sort of the sort of end result, if you sort of hyperbolically imagine being able to replace basically everything but whatever it is that we conceive of as being essential to our life, maybe individual consciousness, or however we sort of imagine that, it becomes a really interesting situation.
Yeah, and one of them talked about, one of the prosthetics group people talked about, I wonder how we're going to be thinking differently once this kind of technology takes off, and you know, we can do kind of more dangerous stuff, but still remember that, you know, we still have nanotech to kind of replace different, I know like nanotech can replace bones mm-hmm. easily, and something to keep in mind.
Yeah, that really really closely with what I was talking about in my paper too, because we're like literally replacing soldiers' bodies with bee bodies. And people
with honeybee bodies,
honeybee bodies, yeah. And so I mean maybe there would be it just seems like there's more comfort in sending honeybees out than there would be humans or even dogs. Because they're replacing dogs that are going out sniffing mines. Now, it could potentially be honeybees out sniffing mines. And so there's this replacement of human bodies, which make people maybe more comfortable starting wars because they know that American human lives will be lost. And there's something to think about.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a huge tradition in literature of thinking about, particularly in indigenous literatures and Native American literatures, like the concept of war and conflict changing through technology. One instance that I always think about is, it was a famous book in the 90s, Leslie Marmon Silko's Ceremony, and one of the main characters goes to war. He's a Native American, and he goes to war, and he comes back, and his family said, well, did you kill someone? And he said, oh, I had to kill a lot of people. And they said, well, what were their faces? What did they look like? What were their names? And their concept of what it meant to take another life was related to how they imagined the conflict and how it was mediated. Whereas now, you know, we have technologies that allow us to end lives from vast distances or through other mediations that require... actually require detachment in order to do it correctly, and so very difficult. So imagining bees using another life, which as far as we know doesn't have the same kind of moral switches in consciousness that a human being would have. Yeah.
This sort of relates to what I'm writing about in my paper, in that a lot of the times we don't think about necessarily how technology is actually affecting us on a biological level, and in that sense, every technology is a biotechnology. And for my example, I chose two arguments that exist within video game studies and related them to claims by Marshall McLuhan on how media affects our perception of the world. And, I don't know, just as an example, basically, when you play a game, you let down certain barriers of your mind in order to accomplish the tasks at hand. And through the overexposure of that, you're training your mind to let down certain walls of fear and empathy in order to accomplish, say, violent tasks in games, which is where the argument comes from, that video games cause violence. But in a sense, what they're causing instead are, how would you say it, more of a...
Well, I mean, the experience of it certainly seems like it's reorganizing what you pay attention to, right, and what you're invested in. You can certainly imagine a game which actually generates more empathy, but there's a lot of games that actually require you not to empathize, right, in order to play the game as its rules are designed. So, yeah, I think that it's definitely something, maybe not in the same sense of, like, biological manipulation or technological manipulation of biology, but the experiential component actually has a biological, consequence. Well, we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to get to the second question. So, you all talked about different particular biotechnologies, and you've all spoke a little bit about each already, but my question was, how has the particular biotechnology that you guys studied in your papers changed the experience of our world or our conception of it? So we've sort of already talked around how it changes our conception of the human or war or these other concepts, but maybe how it changes our perception of the world. Like it's as a thing that we think about, right? Because our worldview is very different now that we have these technologies here.
I think that specifically popular implants and other technologies that are formed to either prevent or cure and treat disabilities have kind of influenced our perspective of the world, that those who aren't disabled are privileged, and those who are disabled just strive to be a little bit more. And it just kind of changes the perception that there is something to normalize to and for everyone else to strive to. And if there are technologies that are available to prevent or to cure or to somehow eliminate those, which it should be.
Yeah, maybe this connects to this larger issue of, because more and more biological processes and organisms are manipulable through technology, it becomes harder and harder to have a worldview. Because, it's very difficult to understand, even with statistics and all the models that we have for sort of measuring the effects of what we're doing to honeybees or what we're doing to our perception processes when we, intervene in something that happened organically. It's very hard to sort of imagine some idea of how things relate on a very general level, because they're all we have this idea that they're all manipulable and they're all changing, so it's almost like we kind of give up on having an idea of how they should relate, because it doesn't seem like it's possible. I don't know. That...
What?
Okay. yeah, go ahead.
I was going to kind of go off of her comments and making the disabled more, or the non-disabled, their privilege. I think it's actually a lot that's going to kind of enhance that idea and concept, is that those who have, because not everyone will have access to a lot of this technology.
Right.
So those who are privileged will continue to become ever more privileged, and those who are unprivileged may continue to become ever more unprivileged. So it'll kind of, the dichotomy of the privileged and the unprivileged will just, the separation will become that much greater. So over the past couple hundred years, the rich have become richer, the poor have become poorer. That same idea, but it makes into kind of whatever advancements come through by technology, if that means living longer, kind of anything and everything is essentially possible through biotechnology. I think kind of going with that, it's hard to imagine everything that is possible currently because we just know there's so much that's not understood, that there's so much more to be figured out in reality.
And maybe that supplements that difficulty of imagining the whole with polarization of imagining the whole, because as we bifurcate along these lines of new technologies, different communities actually have no way of imagining or empathizing. Well, not no way, but it's inhibited, right? Because
they don't have a framework,
right?
I mean, and the fact also first on that is that we have to come up with a new framework to kind of imagine everything that is now capable. And every few years, when another advancement is made, we're going to have to redo our framework and figure out how to put this in kind of the context. And those who are not exposed to it, they're not going to have any type of framework to really kind of understand or conceptualize the possibilities.
I don't know. Does anybody think that we can predict the future of it? I mean, we can't even understand what technology does to ourselves. I mean, what possible framework could we lay out that would accurately predict where something we create is going to take us?
Yeah, but so there's I think one distinction that actually saves these two problems as problems is that even though we may not have like a framework that can speak to an ultimate end or a predictive framework, but a framework that helps promote certain values that a culture would want, like well-being, and that's a workable problem, right? We can actually like figure out what, you know, at least in a particular epoch, what promotes well-being and what doesn't. And you can have frameworks. You need frameworks to enable to answer that question. So, but it's as a macro question of like, can we actually control these processes? I think it's clear that we can't. okay, well, we're out of time, but thank you.